Lars Larson tackles the big stuff today at 6 on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
It's 34 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. I'm glad you are here. Well, we've got some new additional information coming in about that bizarre shutdown of I-5 Monday afternoon in Seattle at rush hour. Rush hour during before a Mariner game to boot. They had traffic backed up to Northgate till about 8 o'clock at night, headed southbound. It was just crazy. Here's a 911 call from one of the witnesses who saw this truck driver. If you hadn't heard about the story, if you were out of town, a guy was driving his truck and stopped it in the middle of the freeway and apparently set it on fire. Again, here's a part of a 911 call.
There's a fire on the bridge. It is in a car. The guy looks insane. You might want to call, like, police as well. Like, he literally looks crazy. Yeah, he got out of the car, put his arms up in there. He's holding a book, and he was, like, scraping in the ground in front of the car. It looked really weird.
Okay, it turns out what he was doing, he wasn't scraping the ground. He was spray painting the pavement near his car. And if you didn't hear what he said he looks insane and he's acting crazy. Channel 7 reporter also spoke to another witness.
Diana De Leon also saw the man, only known as John Doe, and almost stopped to ask if he needed help.
He looked very agitated. He looked frustrated, and my thinking at that point was that, you know, obviously if your truck is on fire in the middle of busy traffic, that you're going to be upset.
When troopers arrived, they said he wouldn't put down his knife. Troopers tasered him and then shot him to death on the Ship Canal Bridge.
We don't know what his intent was, other than it looks like to harm our troopers.
The State Patrol released the name of the troopers involved. Andrew Boyer and Christopher Kyle, both 29. Both are on standard paid leave. Neither has been involved in an officer-involved shooting before.
Okay, a little bit more detail here. Another guy who called 911 was Andrew Giles, according to Jennifer Sullivan, Seattle Times. He and his girlfriend, Jasmine Bill, were driving to the Mariner game, and this brown truck pulls in front of them on I-5 and then stops. And, of course, Andrew Giles, being behind him, slows his car, starts to get out, say, you know, what's going on? You got a problem. And then he sees the guy in the pickup fiddling in the back of his extended cab, and then flames erupt. Well, his pickup's just 10 feet away from his Honda, and his girlfriend says, get back in the truck, get out of here, this guy is trying to blow up the bridge or something. So they drove out of there, of course, calling 911. Now, the driver of the truck, they haven't identified him yet. They're going to do it probably later today, maybe tomorrow, but perhaps today. Was identified as a blonde-haired, bearded, middle-aged guy wearing a checked green shirt, gets out of the truck. He's got a can of green spray paint and a thick book, which may have been a Bible, in his other hand, and he starts painting the pavement. That's when the troopers show up. Didn't take all that long. And one trooper starts extinguishing the fire, and the second trooper walks toward the driver, who's about 50 feet away, who was still spray painting not only the pavement, but they were spray painting other cars. The driver pulls out this large knife and starts walking toward the trooper. So the second trooper goes to help his colleague, and one of them fires a taser at this guy. But as you heard from Maria Guerrero's report on Channel 7, it didn't work. Still not sure why it didn't work. And he keeps advancing on the troopers. They both pull their weapons and let this guy have it. He was taken to Harborview, and we announced on the show yesterday while we were broadcasting that he had died. Jasmine Bill, the girlfriend of Andrew Giles, who was driving to the Mariner game, who I mentioned a moment ago, said, "I'd never seen anything like that. Thank God no one else was hurt." Investigators found an incendiary device inside the guy's pickup. Pretty crude. 1 liter plastic bottle with a cannon fuse. Another caller told the dispatcher, "This guy looks insane. He looks crazy. He's holding something, putting his arms in the air. It looked terrifying." And so here we go again. I mentioned that there's, you know, a common thread between this and the shooting at Seattle Pacific University and the stabbing of that Shoreline University professor, English professor, several months ago after the Sounder game. And that is that in Washington, we have mental health commitment laws that make it hard to put people like this into treatment where they can get three meals a day and they can be looked after and their mental illness can be treated. And instead, in the name of preserving their rights, which mental health zealots are forever trying to do, they just wander and roam and eventually they go off, you know, like a bomb. And, you know, as a consequence, you know, here's Deborah Horn from Channel 7 explaining how difficult it is in this state to deal with the seriously mentally ill.
So what does it take to get treatment for someone who is mentally ill?
The law is very clear about being imminent risk to self or others.
Kathleen Southwick, who runs King County's 24-hour crisis clinic, says it is not easy to get someone committed in this state.
I think there's need to be safeguards on both sides, but perhaps the law is a bit strict. I mean,
it is strict, then.
It is very strict.
And very different in other states. In Maryland, just about anyone can be examined for mental illness and hospitalized up to 30 hours. In Florida, under the Baker Act, a person must only possibly have a mental illness to be involuntarily committed.
And in this state, you have to be at imminent risk of hurting yourself or someone else, imminent, before they will commit you, before you can be involuntarily committed. Aaron Yabarro, the accused Seattle Pacific University shooter, twice they tried to have him committed. Twice he was viewed as, quote, not detainable. So because of our incredibly strict standard, as you just heard, people who would be receiving help are instead just wandering around. And eventually, if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, well, if you're lucky, you'll end up in a long traffic jam. If you're not so lucky, you might get stabbed for the crime of walking down a street by someone you've never seen before. Or you'll be shot on a placid, otherwise safe college campus. And the politicians descend on the campus and start saying, "Aha, another episode of gun violence. We need to take guns seriously." Talk about missing the point. And no one will own up to what the real problem is. They don't want it because the mental health lobby is so intense and so self-righteous and so well organized. They don't want to take them on. They'll say money is an issue, but you got to start thinking about how, because we spend a lot of money on all aspects of mental health, but we don't use compulsion. It is seen as wrong to use compulsion to force people to take their medication or to force people into treatment. Well, somehow that's what you have to do. These people are mentally ill. You don't really have a lot of options all the time. Ybarra, according to Dan Satterberg, King County prosecutor, Aaron Ybarra, deliberately stopped taking his medication because he wanted to feel angry and he needed to kind of, you know, screw up the courage necessary to go on what he thought would be a mass shooting binge, which didn't happen. Number one, because his shotgun misfired. Number two, because John Meese, a student volunteer, heroically pepper sprayed the guy when he was reloading and tackled him. And other students jumped in to, you know, make sure he was disarmed. He had 50 shotgun shells and a big knife as well to finish anyone else off who tried to get too close. So can we please start taking this seriously?